The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, and today we listen in on a conversation that David McIlvaney is having in New Orleans with Marianne and Pamela Aiden. Since 1982, these two sisters have provided a powerful dose of market analysis that not only incorporates excellent short-term recommendation, but also examines accurately the long-term trend analysis as well. Professionals in the investment industry have come to look forward to their comments and considerations as they look both to the long and the short of financial and economic trends. Let's join that conversation now.
Well, y'all have been writing the Aiden forecast since 1982.
Yes.
That was, incidentally, one of the best years for Bordeaux in 100 years. So many good things came from 1982. You've written about currencies, commodities, stocks, bonds, and you've combined both a fundamental and technical analysis to drive home some of your conclusions. You've both lived and traveled outside the United States for decades, 35 years, as you've told me. And that brings to mind a comment that Jim Rogers made last week, quoting Rudyard Kipling. What can one know of England if only England he knows? And with that perspective, you look at the United States, you look at our markets, you look at many overseas markets with an interesting view. It is one certainly marked by a global perspective. We want to look at sort of macro and micro questions, and that would be for markets in particular, and some time frames too, your long-term views on particular asset classes, as well as maybe some immediate concerns when it comes to, say, for instance, the dollar or bonds or whatnot. Love to explore some of those things with you. So with that in mind, I just want to welcome you to our conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice being here.
The major interests that we have are interest rate trends. There's been a lot of talk about transition with interest rates. We've been in one direction with interest rates basically coming down since 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, are we at or near an end to that cycle? Bill Gross, even this week, has suggested perhaps we are. And just want to put that in front of you. What is your long-term view of interest rates in the bond market, and then maybe a short-term view as well?
Well, I think Bill Gross is absolutely right, and I know he's the bond king. And it would coincide with what else is going on around us, looking at the bigger picture, in the sense that you have, as you mentioned, interest rates have been coming down now since the 80s. They're now so low. They've never been this low before. And it's been in an effort to kind of stimulate the economy and part of the stimulus program and all that. But you can only keep them there for so long, because as the dollar falls and as more money is spent and the fundamentals become more unattractive, at some point interest rates will have to start going up to attract lenders around the world. So this is something that makes sense, and it coincides with the fact that gold's going up, commodities are going up. Sooner or later, with all the money that's been spent and is being spent, inflation will start rearing its head again, and then, therefore, interest rates will follow.
Pam, on that same note, interest rates are generally an indication of risk. The higher the rate, there's imputed in that equation some sort of risk that is being measured or put in. We've got low rates, record low rates here in the United States. Is it fair to assume that that's also a measure of low risk, or is that maybe a mispricing in the marketplace?
Mispricing in the marketplace, I'd say. I'd say the risk, it's not a good indicator of risk right this moment. It's doing something else. It's they're low for different reasons. When we have an interest rate spread that's as wide as it's going to be, short-term rates versus long-term rates, say the T-bill 90-day rate versus the 30-year yield, it's not going to get any wider. And it's been sitting at this wide area for a year now. So the next step would be that they start narrowing. Narrowing usually means, in the past decades, has meant that the T-bill rate will rise to catch up to the longer-term yield. And the yield itself is looking like it wants to bottom and turn around, but it's the trend still down for interest rates.
Do either of you think that the FOMC will maintain control of the bond market and the interest rates? You know, certainly they set the short-term rates and the market sets the long rate. Do you foresee a time where the market begins pulling away and they stubbornly keep rates lower, but it's kind of obvious that it can't last?
Yes, definitely they'll do all they can to keep them low for in their interest, a very important interest, to keep interest rates low as long as they can. So they will do all they can, and they have been doing. They've been showing that they're doing this. So this is where the difference is. Risk, high interest rates risk versus low interest rates low risk. That's not appropriate in today's market.
Well, Bill Gross's comments recently, you know, were fairly strong, basically saying that the Fed and the Treasury in combination are running the biggest Ponzi scheme in history. And, you know, it basically is now that we don't need any more patsies. We don't need anyone to come in and perpetuate the Ponzi scheme because the Fed will take care of that. We'll just bloat the balance sheet. What is $2.4 trillion today will just expand to $3 or $4 or $5 trillion if need be. And he's saying that's pretty bold. That's pretty brash. Is that sort of the last desperate act? I mean, there's a lot at stake for the Treasury and the Fed to simply throw in the towel. I would think they'll fight tooth and tong to keep the Treasury market stable and the dollar, if it is to depreciate, at least in a controlled decline as opposed to something more sort of outside of their area of influence.
Oh, I think they'll always be doing what they think is best for the U.S. and but maybe not in the U.S. interest per se, but in the U.S.'s salvation interests, not to, so the system doesn't get interrupted, at least possible. I think they will do what they can. They've been showing they will do that, and they are doing it, and they will continue doing it. But there comes to a point where we may get to that point that becomes an impossible thing for them to do. Like it's out of their control to a point, but so far they're doing what they can, and it's not good for the long-term benefit of the U.S.
Well, that's the bond market and interest rates. The dollar is also very important. What would you say are your long-term views of the dollar, where we're at today, where we're going, and maybe your short-term views, where we're at and where we're going?
Well, the dollar already hit a record low versus Swiss franc, 95 low versus the yen, and it's just a matter of time before the dollar index starts getting close to its record lows. It's not too far from there today. So yes, the dollar is weak, it's hurting, and that's actually, the U.S. wants a weak dollar. They just probably want a contained or balanced, not a collapsing dollar. But that's where the currency wars are coming in, tension and the meetings. Right now, the latest meeting is ease some tension for the moment. But that's for the moment. I think it's going to end up being protectionism. There's already a lot of tension that's not getting resolved. It's just postponed for a month or two.
Do you see the possibility, Marianne, of there being the loss of reserve currency status?
Oh, it's already happening. It's happening slowly, very slowly, but it's happening. And, you know, just to go back for a moment on the bond market is a free market. And the Fed, you know, as you were mentioning, they can do so much, and they will try to do as much as they can, as Pam mentioned. But at some point, the bond market, which is gigantic, it's huge, it's one of the largest markets. And then, of course, there's the currency markets, which are also massive. And these markets will go their own way at some point based on what investors and central banks and people all over the world want to do. And at this point, they are already taking action. At least the central banks are, and I'm sure, you know, millions of private investors, they're easing out of dollars and increasing their diversification within their reserves. Dozens of countries have been putting more euros into their reserves, some gold, and you're seeing it with across the board. And so this too adds to the dollar's decline, which I think eventually, whether the Fed likes it or not, will gain momentum.
There was discussion for some time that the euro would be the substitute for the dollar. Now, a lot's happened in the last 12 months, and the fiscal imbalances and the lack of political cohesion within the European Union, they've had an effect on the EMU. Maybe that's not the alternative. Is there a currency in the next 5 years that could emerge as a substitute for the dollar? Or do we get to keep the status just because we're bad, but we're better than the rest? I mean,
well, that's always a thing to consider. I don't think the dollar is going to ever going away completely. I think it's always going to play a role, but maybe a lesser role. And maybe what it is, it's a basket of currencies with gold included. I think it's still in the works of how maybe it's going to be some, the yuan, the renminbi will be in there, a basket of currencies as a reserve status. And it's almost like it's going to go in through the back door, like Marianne was saying. It's already happening quietly. Some countries want to work directly together. So it's already happening, and all of a sudden, the central banks are going to have this basket of currencies and gold in their reserves. And there it is. And the dollar will not be able, the Fed will not be able to abuse the dollar like it has. It's the only country that's allowed to abuse so much and have it not be, eventually, yes, but for the moment.
Well, what you're describing sounds like the SDR system, the special drawing rights, mm-hmm. a basket of five or six currencies. Gold's not a part of it now, but maybe it gets thrown in. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the way it is given legitimacy. It's not just more of the same, but here's this new component to legitimize.
I just wanted to add to that that part of what we're seeing is, aside from the easing out very slowly, because nobody wants to rock the boat, obviously, but is a lot more, Pam mentioned that, and it's important, very important, the deals within countries. China and Brazil, they made their own deal. We'll buy your resources and, you know, in their own currencies, eliminating the dollar out of the equation. There's a lot of talk that the Gulf countries are going to do that too in pricing their oil. China and Russia made their own deal. It's hard to keep up because it's happening really fast, and a lot of countries are just making their own deals to trade with each other in their own currencies. Well, that is automatically going to be, you know, making their reserves, as this trend increases, more diversified. So it's really interesting what's going on.
It's very historic. We feel it's very historic. We're going through some major part of history right now.
The end of one monetary regime, then perhaps the beginning of a new one. Many people have speculated that gold could be remonetized. Do you think that's possible in the context of the Federal Reserve still existing? That's kind of a capitulation that, okay, we really have failed, which from the standpoint of ego, you certainly wouldn't have seen that in the Greenspan era. Is Bernanke less of an egotist? or do we go back to sort of the Jacksonian days of, we don't need a central bank, let's just close it down and have constitutional money the way the founders intended it?
Well, it's hard to imagine, but it could, anything can happen.
It's to be seen. That's, I think, pretty far in the future. In the meantime, we're going to see a lot more rocky roads.
Well, that does bring up gold and silver in terms of long-term views, short-term views. Y'all are the second ones. Bert Doman, who's been on the program before, has also suggested that the precious metals might be in a very long-term bull market, 20 to 30 year. And y'all are the second ones who've said, at least a long-term, I don't know that you put a time frame to it, but that's intriguing to me. A number of questions for it. Maybe you could kind of lay out what is your long-term view? What is your short-term view? Where are we at? Where are we going?
The long-term view is that so much has happened to get us to where we are right now. And going back to the Bretton Woods Agreement back in, you know, during World War II, then the U.S. going off the gold standard in 1971, and so on. From there on, the dollar started to fall, gold started to rise. But it's not just because of that anymore. It's just uncertainty. It's the massive, massive spending and deficits. There's so many factors. A huge new one that wasn't there in the bull market of the 70s is this massive global demand from all over. And from India, from China, from all these emerging countries that are just booming. And they're doing wonderfully. The growth is still to come for decades into the future. And I think that's where you put this all into perspective. These people all over the world want gold. To them, it's money. It's a form of wealth. It's a really important driving factor. So you kind of have all these factors coming together at the same time, which provides good reason why this probably will be as we call it, a mega bull market. Now, you know, with that said, it's also important to recognize that, and most people do, markets don't go straight up. There's corrections along the way. You have a downward correction that could last 6 months, that doesn't, and then it continues on. And that's the way gold has risen for the past almost 10 years, but slow and steady with corrections along the way. So right now it's probably a bit overextended. It's probably due for one of these corrections. And if anything, we would say, if you haven't bought yet, use that as a good buying opportunity.
So sort of the two steps forward, one step back.
Exactly.
It's making progress slowly. This is where, in terms of time frame, I have lots of questions, because if you look at the journey thus far, 10 years, we started at a very low price. And it might be helpful for listeners to stop thinking in terms of prices at all, because certainly in the context of an eroding currency, price is less relevant. For instance, the price of silver in 1923 in Weimar Germany. I mean, you're talking about billions of marks. All that is commentary on the currency, not necessarily the supply and demand dimensions of that commodity market.
Well, I saw a little bit of that in Nicaragua up hand in the 80s, because I would go there a lot. My husband was living there, so I would go there often. And they had runaway inflation. The Sandinistas at the time just didn't understand or know about money, and they didn't care to know, and they just printed. So you saw the people on the street, they couldn't even afford the paper. So they would just put a stamp. Instead of a 10,000, it was a 100,000 note. And if you wanted to buy dinner for $1, it would be $3, very cheap. In their Cordobas, you would have a bag, a suitcase full of, because they didn't have credit cards, a bags of money to pay for your dinner. And that we saw firsthand, and saw how the people would say, what's the price today? Well, right now it's this. I can't tell you what it is this afternoon.
Oh, and I remember when we all went out to dinner one night, there was a group of about six of us, and one of the men that was treating had his bag stuffed with money, and when the meal was over, he just dumped it in the middle of the table, and the waiters didn't even bother to count it. It was just, I mean, that it's really interesting to see. Yeah.
As an office, we read a book every month. I probably annoy the guys in the office. This is how I expect them to spend their free time, reading something work-related. but the one that we're reading this month is called The Death of Money. It was written in 1975, and it's been reprinted and written by a British gent. And it's not a book on economics. It's a book on sort of the sociology of inflation. What happens in the when you're paying those bills? What does someone do who works at that restaurant? How do you account for the costs out of the actual food that you prepared and put on the table versus someone who just dumps a bag of money? And it's overwhelming. You
yeah,
can't even
totally
count it.
You could see, it was totally overwhelming. That's what was so interesting to see. The people on the street, they had to survive. They could not tell you what the cost of their mango was going to be that afternoon, or some lettuce. And then you go to the central market, and where prices were a little bit higher, as they call the extra enjedos, they was all beautiful, beautiful produce. But the people couldn't buy that. It was a very interesting time to analyze how people are, like you were saying, how they are with a runaway inflation.
I guess that's why when I think of the price of gold today and compare it, say, to the Dow, we started this bull market at a ratio of 43-1.
Right.
We're at about 8-1 today.
Right.
So we've covered a lot of ground. That's a five-fold move in terms of that ratio's change, a 500% change. Now, what we see from here to the classic numbers, gold is classically, relating to the Dow, has ended at a 3-1 or a 2-1 or a 1-1 ratio. And we also know that in most bull markets, things tend to speed up as more people participate. So my sense is certainly one of concern that actually we're getting to the last third of the market where things could speed up and move parabolic. And that could be it. Now, what you all are talking about is something far more structural in change, I think, where whether it is remonetization or where it gains a larger global audience and maybe this generational repricing, unlike the last one, which took us from 35 to 875, maybe this one takes us into numbers we can't imagine because you're just dealing with no supply whatsoever on the gold side.
Exactly. Like, we really don't know to what the upside is open. It's more important to know you're on the right side of a mega trend and you just stay with it. This is what we firmly believe. And then you can take it on the upside down and say, do you think the dollar's going to get strong over the next couple of years? No. Do you think there's going to be a structural difference in the world? And if you don't think if that's not going to happen in your mind, then yes, the gold price is going to continue to go up higher. And is there a great demand in commodities today? It's a very, very strong demand. This demand is what's going to keep the commodity world going. Resources and agriculture and gold continue rising for other reasons. Silver doing better, probably. And this is the historical mega trend we're seeing change that's going on as the emerging world emerges.
Is it possible? I mean, if we've seen a 1-to-1 ratio as recently as 1980, the Dow is at 800, gold is at 800. Is it possible to see that ratio go negative, where the value, the nominal value of gold is significantly higher than the Dow?
Well, anything's possible.
Oh,
that's
I never thought about that.
I know. We always think 1-to-1 and that's the end of it. And
anything is possible. I mean, who knows?
The important thing is to have an open mind and stay on the right side of the trends and know that we're in very unusual times in so many ways. And know that it's probably not going to unfold like we have ever seen before.
Well, with the secular trends in place, just with general suggestions in mind, staying on the right side of the trend, is that still being long gold, avoiding the dollar if possible, other commodities selectively, assuming that there's... That's a question. When it comes to commodities, we touched on that a little bit earlier on gold. To what degree are some commodities just being repriced for devalued currencies versus some being repriced given true supply and demand dimensions? Because you don't have to have a currency devaluation to see a commodity go up, and yet you can see that be a major driver in terms of the repricing of a commodity. What are we seeing? Is this supply and demand driven? I mean, certainly a few years ago there was speculative demand for commodities, and up through 2008 we saw a major boom, then a bust. Is this the inflation-deflation debate playing out, or is it supply and inflation-deflation being a monetary function, or is it supply and demand being that there's, say, in China, for instance, in the last 30 years we've added 300 million new people to the above-average consumer level in China. You know, these are people with better jobs and more than two bowls of rice a day. So is that the demand, actual demand versus just monetary degradation?
It's probably both, a bit of both, I'd say. Definitely the demand's there. And yeah, they're a bowl of rice, but they also want a car and they want some more nice things in their house. And there's a lot of people. And it's not just China. It's India. It's Brazil. It's Latin America in general. Everybody wants things. They want to have a better life. And they're coming from very low to normal. So it's going into the middle class. It's not going into a high class. So yes, there's a lot of demand for infrastructure and therefore copper, zinc, the base metals, and resources, and oil alternatives eventually, and agriculture.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, as you all have lived in Costa Rica for 35 years, and many of our listeners and subscribers often wonder, where else would you choose to live? Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, Chile, if sort of in the North American, Latin American, South American strip. Is Costa Rica a good place? Is that you've been there a long time. Maybe it's too inconvenient to move. Or do you really still feel that's one of the better destinations in the world?
Oh, we like it there. And I know lately a lot of people have been talking about Argentina, which is also lovely, and Chile is wonderful. But there's probably so many different places. I think Mexico's kind of off the radar a little bit. Just recently, I was just at this conference, I was talking to some people that were seriously thinking of relocating at least part-time to Mexico, and now they're having doubts. But then I talked to people who actually lived there, had relocated and had been there for several years, and they said, oh, what you read in the news is so hyped out of proportion, as is often the case. So it's really up to, I think, for several things. First, it's up to the person as far as how much money they have available. If price is a big factor, then you want to go somewhere where there's, you know, you can get more for your money.
Versus Geneva, for instance.
Exactly. Then you want to factor in what you like. Do you like the beach? Do you like the forest? Do you like the mountains? Do you want a really peaceful environment? The climate? There's so many things. So I think if anyone's thinking of going anywhere, it's always good to go there and spend at least a couple months, if they can, a month, at least a vacation, and see if they think they would like it. Because so often it's glamorized and it's, you know, you still get down to the old daily grind and you've got your things and there's going to be things you don't like. Very hard to accept sometimes a different culture, more so than people think. And so things that you would take for granted in the U.S., for example, you probably won't get a lot of those in a different country, or it'll be different. So those are things that people have to acclimate
and realize that it's there. But no, there's a lot of expats there. There's a lot. In fact, there was just a few months ago, one of the Oxford Club had a seminar for moving to Costa Ricans, checking it out. And they had the biggest turnout. And we went and spoke there, but we were speaking about personal, no market talk. It was all about how we like Costa Rica for the last 35 years and what do we think about how our life's been and how it's changed, because that's what they were focusing on. So it was actually fun to talk about that, because our life has been good and we like it. And all those people that came, that's what they were there for. They said it's one of their biggest turnouts in years.
And it was just people wanting to find out about moving to Costa Rica.
Well, you shared perspective with that group. We appreciate you sharing perspective with us today. You've recently been given the responsibility or taken over the responsibility for Harry Schultz's letter. Quite an honor, fine, venerable gentleman, and he's been writing for a long, long time. I know he wouldn't entrust that to anyone but the finest minds. And we look forward to you carrying on that legacy. Is there anything that you would want to share with us, you know, that is more perspective? Y'all have been in the investment business and around that world for enough time for your opinions to count. Unfortunately, I have not. But it's with time and experience that you begin to see things probably a little bit more clearly.
I don't know. I'm impressed with all your experiences. Yes. And really, you've done remarkable things. And so it's, you know, the years, I mean, you can spend a lot of years doing something and not necessarily gain a lot of perspective, or you can't. But I think you do, I guess, I don't know, maybe not stress too much about it. As Richard Russell always says, you know, invest to the point where you can sleep at night. I mean, they're such simplistic things, but I remember we used to stress a lot more when we were younger about meeting our deadline or if a market turned against us, you know. But now, and really that's part of that investing with the big trends, is just, it does give you a more peace of mind. Now, if you're younger and you will like the excitement of trading, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But I think as someone gets older, they're less inclined to do that sort of thing. But it all depends, again, on the...
No, but just like the run-up in October, all of a sudden, all these day and day go, a little tiring to run up too fast. And so this, by the fact you feel that way, it's probably an intermediate top. And so those are the kind of feelings the ebb and flow of things start, unless it's just a total collapse like happened in 2008, where everything went much farther than everyone was expecting, I'd say. Very few weren't. So aside from disaster, the ebb and flow of markets, we follow those closely too. We measured the declines in gold and silver, and we can see that gold rising 95% in the last 2 years, straight up from the depth of the financial crisis to today, just shows you, and silver doubling that, almost 180%, and turning extra bullish in the meantime. So this is telling us where everything wants to go.
Yeah, it's certainly our effort to recognize the trends, hopefully anticipate the transitions, and we appreciate you helping us with some of that clarity. So hopefully we can call on you, and we have more questions and looking for deeper insight, we can revisit the conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks. You very much.
Thank
we appreciate it.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and the Aiden Sisters. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or feel free to give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.